The headlines and hand-wringing over artificial intelligence are at almost a fever pitch. This week, Techonomics host Jason Middleton responded to some tweets about AI, and that led to this week's discussion with a Silicon Valley thought leader.
Hello and welcome back. This week, it's a variation on a Techonomics theme, helping society leather up and deal with the coming sea change that artificial intelligence is bringing. Not will bring, not might bring. It's here. AI and machine learning capabilities are only going to get more sophisticated and more efficient. And some thought leaders, like this week's guest, would like us to socially pump the brakes a little bit as we integrate artificial intelligence.
So when you don't have any social stature, when you don't have to go to work and meet people and interact with people, what do you do with your life? I mean, are all people going to sit back and say, okay, we want to learn how to play music now or seek enlightenment? I don't think so.
Machines that learn how to repair themselves, image and pattern recognition that exceeds the human brain's capacity of processing. Heck, even fake news is a result of existing artificial intelligence.
Now imagine this on an exponential curve, not having today's Donald Trump, but having 100 other Donald Trumps and now having problems 100 times of the magnitude.
There's some social context for us. And now here's our chat.
Vivek Wadhwa, I'm a distinguished fellow at Carnegie Mellon University in Silicon Valley.
I was wondering what triggered you or keyed you on artificial intelligence, because you took to Twitter with something and I responded, and then after a couple of those, we decided to carve out some time to have a chat. What was it that got you to Twitter on AI?
You know, Jason, for AI, we've been hearing about it since we were young. We thought it was the stuff of science fiction. And then we grew up and nothing happened. We thought AI was a hoax. Well, that AI wasn't, you know, real. Now, the last 5 or 7 years or so, there have been advances in something called machine learning, in which you have the ability to mimic the human brain. The way the brain works is that when we see an object, we recognize it's round, it's square, you know, it has this type of shape. And then that's one set of neurons. They classify it and take sent to the second set of neurons. And there's basically a layer of neurons in our brain which identify an object. And when the mother tells us that this is a cat, this is a dog, we begin to now assign weights to each of the factors in those neurons. But essentially, we learn through example. We learn by observing. We learn by doing things. That they replicated that same method in artificial intelligence software, deep learning, neural networks, machine learning, they're all related words, but they essentially mimic the human brain in software. Now, this seems like an obvious idea, but until about 5 or 10 years ago, it wasn't feasible because it required massive computing. You needed supercomputers to do this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, thanks to our kids who love playing computer games, computer games were really hard, so they needed very sophisticated graphics processing. So NVIDIA, which is a Silicon Valley-based company, developed what was called the graphic processing unit, the mm-hmm. GPU, which does the same type of processing that the brain would do. But essentially, they developed the core technology for it, and the technology became more and more powerful and cheaper. So now what's happening all over the world is that the software necessary to build the machine intelligence is being used and is affordable. And the hardware for it has become relatively inexpensive. The result is that the stuff we saw in science fiction is getting closer and closer and closer. And we're able to teach AI almost anything that requires decision making. Anytime you have to look at data and analyze it and now interpret it, computers are beginning to be able to do it as well as humans can. And they're learning from humans. We're basically teaching them how we think, how we make decisions, and this is being applied to almost every field. So if you move forward now, next 5 or 10 years, the hardware will continue to get cheaper and cheaper and more powerful. The software will become more sophisticated. The amount of data that we have will increase tremendously, and we would have taught our computers how to interpret it. So which means that practically any job that a human does that requires decision-making can now be done by artificial intelligence.
Okay.
That's the good news. The bad news is, what do human beings do? And this is what I've been raising on Twitter, and this is what's beginning to worry me. Everywhere I look, I see machines now becoming as good as humans are. So I talked about the intelligence part of it, which is machine learning and AI. You also now have robots, the stuff out of science fiction, robots that can do human-like things, which are now being enhanced with machine intelligence.
Well, Vivek, let me take a devil's advocate view here. What if we just let the machines do what they do best, something binary? And you're right, predictive analytics, of course, in their interpretation coming as well. The labor sector disruption is undeniable. So what humans do best is really be bad at stuff like relationships or trial and error, the scientific method, creativity, art. Wouldn't this free up time for us to have more energies to do the creative stuff?
It will. But the trouble is there'll be fewer of us that do the jobs. So what happens to the 60, 70, 80% of the population that aren't needed anymore, that do grunt work right now? You know, even today, when you look at business, you only have a few people making decisions in the business. Everyone else just does grunt work. They go in and they analyze spreadsheets, or they operate machines, or they fill out forms. You know, they do grunt work. Those jobs disappear. What happens to those people? So fine, you're a smart guy. You know what predictive analytics means. So you'll be employable. What happens to everyone else who has no clue what you're talking about?
Okay. What it is it's a conundrum. And I hear you, societally speaking. One idea that seems to be bandied about is universal basic income. The concept that citizens would get a monthly income regardless of whatever, and then they would take away some of the social safety network that's underneath it to help pay for it, and then people could move forward with known income coming. Now, I don't think that $1,500 a month is going to survive long in San Francisco, but it might play out in, I don't know, rural Nebraska or rural Midwestern states. Is UBI an option?
Okay, Jason, let's go one step further. Let's assume that the cost of everything becomes practically zero. In other words, you have unlimited clean energy, unlimited communications, knowledge. I mean, you're able to 3D print everything you need. This is where we're headed. The cost of everything drops, so that $1,500 may take you a long way, even in San Francisco, other than your rent, which is a different issue, but let's keep that aside.
Right.
But the point is that let's say that you can afford to live now. You'll go and keep yourself busy. You'll read books. But many others in society, in fact, I would argue that the most people would feel very unhappy because their identity is based on their work. You know, when you meet someone, the first thing you ask them is, what do you do?
Right.
We're identified by our jobs. That's what our social stature is based on. We don't ask people, hey, what musical instrument do you play? What are your hobbies? That's just a small chit-chat.
Right.
That might be something you do when you run out of things to ask people about. But when you don't have any social stature, when you don't have to go to work and meet people and interact with people, what do you do with your life? I mean, are all people going to sit back and say, okay, we want to learn how to play music now or seek enlightenment? I don't think so. So the vast majority of society is going to be depressed, is going to be unhappy. They're not going to know how to react to all of this. So this is the problem in this jobless future we're talking about. Now, for Silicon Valley, the reason why we talk so much about UBI is because it's very convenient for the Valley to say, hey, there's a solution to this problem. You know, the mantra over here is, let us get filthy rich. Let us disrupt entire industries. Let us do whatever we want to do. Leave us alone. And by the way, government can give out handouts to everyone so that it's not a problem. So we're kicking the can down the hill. We're saying it's someone else's problem by hyping the heck out of UBI. You know, 5 years ago, we even had people denying that there was a jobless future coming. Now the realization is set in. No one can deny it anymore. Right. Even Mark Zuckerberg has realized that the technologies we're creating here in Silicon Valley are going to lead to mass joblessness, that we have a responsibility over here. But again, if you say that UBI will solve the problem, then you don't have to have a guilty conscience anymore. This is why I'm in favor of UBI, by the way. I mean, I believe in it. Right. However, I've started being critical about it because it's become convenient for Silicon Valley to blame someone else for the problem.
I see.
And to shove it down to him.
So somebody like Jason Calacanis, who's on the show a lot, comes in, talks about UBI being it, and just kind of, you know, washes his hands of it and walks away to his next investment kind of thing.
What? Exactly, because he's not taking responsibility. We are not taking responsibility for the joblessness we're creating. We should be worried a lot about it. We created the fake news. We created the ability for Donald Trump to get elected with our technologies. We didn't build the filtering mechanisms into it. We didn't take responsibility for what we created. And look at what happened at the national level. Now, imagine this on an exponential curve, not having today's Donald Trump, but having 100 other Donald Trumps and now having problems 100 times of the magnitude. This is what we're creating in Silicon Valley.
Vivek Wadhwa, he's a distinguished fellow at Carnegie Mellon University, and he's based here in Silicon Valley. To clarify, I called him Dr. Wadhwa during that interview, but he did correct me afterwards. He is not a PhD. He just is really smart and articulate. Vivek is also the author of a recent book titled Driving the Driverless Car. We are going to get into that and some other aspects of artificial intelligence in a segment coming up. Things like universal basic income and the lack of Silicon Valley's ownership of the disruption it causes to society.
We have to worry about what happens if this does get into autopilot and decides to learn everything on its own and consider the human race to be unnecessary.
We're saving that segment for the bottom of the hour. Coming up next is millennial retirement. Yes, even with student loan debt, it can happen. Planning to retire is not a pipe dream. An author and award-winning financial planner talks with us about his and his wife's new book, The Millennial Money Fix. That's right after the break. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.